Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Friday, January 17th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just four names: Charles Reese Harpst, known as Charlie, no age given, of the Valley; Joni Lee, 92, of Phoenix; Mary E. Lohman, 102, of Phoenix; and Lance McClure, 76, of the Valley. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in those obituaries. Now we turn to the business section of the paper. Looks like there's three articles here. The first one was written by Russ Wiles, who is a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, TSMC Ahead of Schedule, Post $11.5 Billion Profit. Here's what Russ wrote. The company building a massive semiconductor complex in Arizona ended 2024 on a strong financial footing and confirmed that it has already launched its much-anticipated commercial production at the North Phoenix site, ahead of schedule. Dr. C.C.Y., that's spelled W.E.I., who is the CEO and chairman of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, said, quote, "We were able to pull ahead the production schedule of our first fab in Arizona," unquote. Now, he spoke during an earnings call on Thursday that the company said it had earned a profit of around $11.5 billion in the fourth quarter, ending December 31st, on revenue of $26.9 billion. Commercial production at the Arizona fab, or factory, was widely expected to start in early 2025. However, the company began high-volume output during the fourth quarter of 2024, using their advanced 4-nanometer technology, with yields or results comparable to that achieved by its fabs in Taiwan. The semiconductor technology now being used by TSMC in Phoenix is the most sophisticated on U.S. soil. The company considers microscopic semiconductors of 7 nanometers or smaller to be its most advanced. Around 80,000 to 100,000 nanometers would fit into a human hair, with a nanometer defined as 1 billionth of a meter. Wei cited, quote, "strong commitment and support from our U.S. customers," unquote, and from federal, Arizona, and Phoenix officials for helping the company make substantial progress. He added and said, quote, "We expect a smooth ramp-up process, and with our strong manufacturing capability and execution, we are confident we can deliver the same level of manufacturing quality and reliability from our fab in Arizona as from our fabs in Taiwan," unquote. Now, TSMC currently employs around 2,200 people in Phoenix, with more jobs planned as it expands, in addition to the various construction positions. The company expects to employ 6,000 people by the end of the decade. Wei said that TSMC's plans for its second and third fabs at the North Phoenix site, quote, "are also on track," unquote. And he went on and said these factories, quote, "will utilize even more advanced technologies," unquote. And that includes those on a scale of 2 nanometers or 3 nanometers. He concluded by saying, thus, TSMC will continue to play a critical and integral role in enabling our customers' success while remaining a key partner and an enabler of the U.S. semiconductor industry," unquote. Now, large-scale commercial production by TSMC in Phoenix marks an important threshold in a relationship between the company and the city, state, and federal officials that began more than a decade ago. And at $65 billion, the company's three-fab complex, located near Dove Valley Road and 43rd Avenue, marks the largest direct foreign investment in the United States. The update on the Arizona factories came during the earnings report, when TSMC said that its net income for the fourth quarter ended December 31st, they vaulted to 57%, and that was on a 38.8% jump in revenue, reflecting the rising demand for its smallest and most advanced products. Now, Wendell Huang, who is TSMC's Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, said, quote, "Our business in the fourth quarter was supported by strong demand for our industry-leading 3-nanometer and 5-nanometer technologies," unquote. He also cited a continued steady demand for semiconductors, which are used in artificial intelligence applications. And that was TSMC ahead of schedule, post $11.5 billion profit. Our second article from the business page, also written by Russ Wiles. It's entitled, ASU Wins $1.2 Billion for Chip Research. Arizona State University's affiliated research programs and laboratories will receive $1.2 billion in new funding for semiconductor packaging, winning 2 of 4 new national awards announced by the U.S. Commerce Department on Wednesday. Now, the biggest prize, worth $1.1 billion, will go to the NATCAST Advanced Packaging Facility to be built in the ASU Research Park in Southeast Tempe. This laboratory will be part of an effort to bridge the gap between research and commercial production and will involve testing new materials and devices used in specific packaging segments. NATCAST is a nonprofit entity tied to the Commerce Department and will own the new facility, which was announced on January 6th, but without a definitive funding amount. Now, that laboratory is expected to draw researchers from around the nation, from startups to large manufacturers. Packaging is the process of protecting semiconductors and connecting them to the myriad of electronic devices that they power. It's in intricate ways that ensures performance and enhanced speeds while minimizing power use, all on an increasingly diminutive scale. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo, in a prepared statement, said, quote, "Bolstering our advanced packaging capabilities is key to America remaining a global leader in leading-edge semiconductor manufacturing," unquote. So these and other investments under the CHIPS and Science Act, she said, will, quote, "will strengthen our end-to-end semiconductor ecosystem and help close the gap between invention and commercialization to ensure the U.S. is a global leader in semiconductor innovation and manufacturing," unquote. Now, the Commerce Department also finalized awards of $100 million each to projects in two other states. One will go to Absolics, A-B-S-O-L-I-C-S, Absolics Incorporated, located in Covington, Georgia, to support the company's research in glass core packaging, which focuses on reducing power consumption and the complexity of the semiconductor system used in artificial intelligence and high-performance computing and data centers. But that's in addition to the $100 million for Applied Materials, located in Santa Clara, California, for packaging used in energy-efficient AI and high-performance computing. Now, Applied Materials also will conduct research at the NATCAST facility at ASU. Arizona already has received a disproportionately high amount of awards under the CHIPS Act, including $6.6 billion for the new Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Complex in North Phoenix, as well as about $3.9 billion for Intel's campus in Chandler, and around $400 million going to Amkor Technology, which is a leading package provider. They're building a new plant in Peoria. And that was the article, ASU Wins $1.2 Billion for Chip Research. Our third article from the business page, LGBTQ plus creators brace for Meta's rule changes, written by Adam Smith from the Thomson Reuters Foundation out of London. Queer creators fear Meta's decision to change its community standards to allow more incendiary language against people of different races and LGBTQ plus people, which could silence their voices, harm livelihoods, and damage their mental health. The changes to Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram and Threads, was announced last week by CEO Mark Zuckerberg, with critics saying the move was designed to appeal to President-elect Donald Trump, who takes office next week. Zuckerberg said in a video released on January 7th, quote, "We've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship. It's time to get back to our roots around free expression," unquote. Meta's new global rules allow, quote, "allegations of mental illness or abnormality when based on gender or sexual orientation, given political and religious discourse about transgenderism and homosexuality, and common non-serious usage of words like weird." Meta now also permits, quote, "content arguing for gender-based limitations of military, law enforcement, and teaching jobs. We also allow the same content based on sexual orientation when the content is based on religious beliefs," unquote, according to their new standards. Now, Jonathan Archart, who is CEO of California-based marketing firm The Postcard Agency, said in an email to the Thomson Reuters Foundation, quote, "Meta's new policies regarding hateful conduct gives users the green light to share hateful rhetoric against LGBTQ plus people, plain and simple. Meta is fanning the fire of hate-fueled discourse with serious repercussions," unquote. Scott Seitz, who is CEO of SPI Marketing in Connecticut, said the changes jeopardize the social safety net that helps sustain the mental well-being of LGBTQ plus users. He said, quote, "The consequences will be devastating. Increased suicide rates, hate crimes, and pervasive discrimination against women and diverse communities," unquote. Now, some creators, however, see a possible upside to the changes that could boost political content in the algorithm, leading to more exposure for LGBTQ plus posts. So as a result, creators like S.K. Smigel, who is non-binary and posts about gender issues from Maryland, could see an increase in reach. In an email, he wrote, "I'm already very used to a heavy flow of both positive and negative engagement on my page. Knowing the changes will likely increase the negative engagement is disheartening, but not entirely discouraging. Any visibility on a trans plus creator's account can be a positive thing, in my opinion. I know that not everyone feels this way, though," unquote. They are worried, however, about the effect on brand partnership deals, and they plan to encourage users to support them on other platforms, such as the donation site Patreon, to make up any shortfall. Jamie Love, who is founder of the London-based social commerce and influencer marketing agency called Monumental Marketing, said that brands could be deterred from partnering with creators under the new rules. In an email, he wrote, quote, "Simply put, brands will not want to invest in platforms that can harm marginalized voices. It's not just about ethics. it's good business, unquote. Some influencer and marketing agencies in the U.S. and across Europe, especially those focused on LGBTQ representation, have been advising creators to disable comments on their post. Cora Hamilton, who heads the Berlin-based LGBTQ marketing agency called UNS, U-N-S, she wrote in an email, quote, "When our talent, especially the content creators that we represent, get hate online, we always recommend that they simply do not engage. And that means deleting comments and messages, reporting and blocking users. It's a quick fix, but it doesn't mean that the creators aren't impacted by the hateful things that are said to them," unquote. The postcard agency, among others, is also advising creators to diversify across social media sites, including by joining Blue Sky and Pinterest and Substack, and to favor platforms they control, like personal blogs. Sites said the biggest platforms for LGBTQ+ users alongside Instagram are LinkedIn and TikTok. He said, "While migrating away may take time, it's crucial to start working your followers over to alternative platforms, where many in the LGBTQ+ community have already begun to build a presence," unquote. However, TikTok is also under threat in the United States, as the video sharing app may be banned over national security concerns unless the Chinese parent ByteDance sells it. Now, in the biggest overhaul of its approach to managing political content on its services, Meta also said that it will scrap its U.S. fact-checking program. These changes could see it run up against legislation in Europe, such as the Digital Services Act, under which it could be fined up to 6% of its revenue for failing to remove illegal content. Meta says it will continue to remove posts that break the law, but Zuckerberg conceded that changes to content filters meant, quote, "We're going to catch less bad stuff," unquote. And that was the third article entitled, "LGBTQ+ Creators Brace for Meta's Rule Changes." Well, we're coming up on 18 minutes past the hour. It's time for us to move over to the sports section. Well, it looks like there's four articles on the front page of the sports section. But we're going to start with the one with the big picture at the top of the page. Suns go big. And it's a picture of Nick Richards from the Charlotte Hornets, who they have traded for. And it's Richards going up for a layup. And looks like he's kind of being defended by two Suns players, but he's a big man. And the article was written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic, but it comes out of Washington, D.C. The Phoenix Suns have Nick Richards to help address two glaring ills, rebounding and defense. The Suns are 25th in rebounding and 22nd in defensive rating. That's not close to good enough for a team with championship aspirations. So, the Suns traded Josh Okogie and three future second-round picks to Charlotte for the 7-foot Richards and a future second-round selection. Suns superstar Kevin Durant said, "Excited to get him in the program. We know what we're getting from an athletic standpoint, a big that can finish over the rim. It's all about getting reps together and seeing how it works. I'm looking forward to it." Richards wasn't with the team at Thursday's morning's shoot-around at Georgetown University. The Suns, who are 19-20, face the Washington Wizards, which are 6-32, in the second of their five-game road trip on Thursday. Richards is expected to be with them by Saturday's game against Detroit. Suns wingman Royce O'Neal said, "That height, big body, I feel like he's a great rebounder and a rim protector and finishing around the rim. That's what we need, especially on the rebounding end. It's a bigger body for us." The Suns are still without 7-footer Yusuf Nurkic, who will miss his third straight game with the flu, as he is still in Phoenix. Bradley Beal has been downgraded from doubtful to out for Thursday's game against his former team. Beal was at Thursday's morning's shoot-around, but he was walking around with a noticeable limp. Phoenix addressed its size issue by adding Richards. He averaged 11.3 points on 61.7% shooting, 10.2 rebounds and 1.7 blocks, and 27.2 minutes in 9 starts with the Hornets. For the season, he is averaging 8.9 points per game on 56.1% shooting, 7.5 rebounds, 1.2 blocks, and 21 minutes per game in the 21 games with Charlotte. He was a second-round pick in the 2020 draft, and he was in his 5th NBA season out of Kentucky. Durant said, "He's a strong presence in the paint, a big body that can wreak havoc down there and cause some problems with his rim protection. Getting his hands on the basketball on the offensive glass and then finishing above the rim, it is something we all have to get better at as a group. Hopefully, he leads us in that area, just controlling the paint," unquote. Well, the Suns are 11th in the West. They are looking to build momentum after going 3-0 in their recent homestand. But the Suns opened the road trip with a 122-117 loss at Atlanta. The Hawks scored 27 points off of 20 offensive rebounds as backup big Onyeka Okongwu posted a double-double of 22 points and 21 rebounds, with 10 coming on the offensive end. Suns coach Mike Budenholzer said after Tuesday's loss to the Hawks, quote, "It starts with everybody who is out there has got to participate. Everybody who is out there has got to commit to rebounding. Are there other guys or other things that we can do to help our rebounding? Well, we've got to look at that and see where we can get better. But everybody that's out there has got to make a commitment to go get it. That's where it always starts," unquote. Well, the next day, the Suns traded for Richards and traded Okogie. Now, Richards is on the second of his 3-year, $15 million deal, with the third year non-guaranteed, while Okogie is on a 2-year, $16 million contract with the second year non-guaranteed. Okogie, as an athletic wing defender, he's having a career year on three-pointers. He's averaged 6 points. He shot 38% from distance in 25 games with the Suns, and he was in his third season with them. Durant said, "I really appreciated how Josh approached the game and his love for his teammates. I wish him the best. I'm sure we'll cross paths again. He's a great teammate, but I am looking forward to having Nick on the team." And that was the article entitled "Suns Go Big." Our next article, team has to assess value of 26 cards, written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. The off-season is here, so it's time to look ahead to what the 2025 Arizona Cardinals could look like. Now, for general manager Monty Ossenfort, the first step of that process is determining which of Arizona's 26 free agents to re-sign. The Cardinals extended their two most important players whose contracts were set to expire. That'd be James Conner and Budda Baker. The team has until March 12th to negotiate extensions with the rest of that group. If an agreement can't be reached, players will become free agents on that date. By total players, the Cardinals have a lengthy list of free agents. But by snaps played, they are losing a fairly typical amount of production. And crucially, none of their stars. So this is part one of the list of Cardinals free agents, breaking down the offensive players whose contracts are expiring. Now, unrestricted free agents are free to sign with any team at the start of the new league year on March 12th. The majority of players, especially the high-profile ones, are unrestricted free agents. Will Hernandez, OG Hernandez, poses a unique conundrum. Through 4.5 games, he played very meaningful snap at right guard, and he was one of the Cardinals' better performers. And then, in Week 5, against the 49ers, he suffered a season-ending knee injury. So by season's end, Hernandez was walking around the locker room without a knee brace or a limp. He appeared likely to be ready for training camp. But the Cardinals have to decide whether to re-sign a 29-year-old coming off of a serious injury. And then we have Evan Brown, OG Brown. Well, he's a sixth-year journeyman. He played nearly every meaningful snap at left guard, and he performed well, especially against the pass. He was charged with only 2 sacks and would be a useful player for the Cardinals to extend. But signing a marquee player at guard is their clearest route to improving an average offensive line. If they opt to use significant resources at the position, it could come at Brown's expense. Then we have Kelvin Beachum, O.T. Beachum. Well, he proved to be a valuable backup at swing tackle in his 13th season, and he said earlier this month that he does not plan to retire. The question for the Cardinals is whether fifth-round rookie Christian Jones is ready to step into Beachum's role as the primary backup at both tackle spots. Then there's Tristan Collin, also an offensive guard. He filled Hernandez's role well after his injury, but he was eventually supplanted by third-round rookie Isaiah Adams. So Collin could have a role as a backup, depending on the Cardinals' other offensive line moves. Then there's Zay Jones, wide receiver. After missing the first 5 weeks through suspension, Jones worked his way up to playing roughly a third of the offensive snaps by the back half of the season. He had his best game in the finale against San Francisco with 4 catches for 46 yards. On the year, he had 8 catches for 84 yards as the Cardinals' 4th wide receiver. Then we have Jackson Barton. OT, he performed admirably when called into action against Detroit's Aiden Hutchinson in Week 4, but he is no more than a reserve at offensive tackle. He spent most of the season as the second backup behind Beachum. Then we've got Zach Pascal, wide receiver. Pascal did not earn a target while playing 6.2% of the offensive snaps, mostly on running plays. At this point in his career, his role is primarily on special teams. Now, teams can place a few different levels of tenders on restricted free agents. 1-year contracts that players essentially must sign. Under these contracts, players become free agents, but their previous team has the ability to match any contract offer. So if no team offers them a contract in free agency, they play for their previous team at a predetermined amount of money. So first-round tenders, which require the signing team to give the original team a first-round pick, are worth roughly $7 million. Second-round tenders are worth roughly $5 million. Right of first refusal tenders are worth roughly $3 million and do not come with draft pick compensation, but they still give the original team the right to match any contract offer. Now, Greg Dortch, wide receiver, is the only restricted free agent on offense. He is also likely the only restricted free agent upon whom the Cardinals would place a tender. As their primary slot receiver, he finished with 37 catches on 50 targets for 342 yards while playing 39% of the offensive snaps. The Cardinals' offense does not heavily use slot receivers, but they would have to replace Dortch somehow if he does depart in free agency. Other free agents, well, there's Travis Vokolek, tight end. He's an exclusive rights free agent, meaning the Cardinals have to offer him a contract at only the league minimum to retain his services, and if they do, he must sign. While Vokolek was rarely active on game days, he spent the whole season on the active roster as the team's fourth tight end. And that was the article by Theo Mackey. Team has to assess the value of 26 cards. Our third article from the front page of the sports section is about baseball. D-backs bullish on funding for Chase Field. This was written by Nick Pecoro, a reporter for the Arizona Republic. As Diamondbacks officials made their case for legislation that would help pay for a Chase Field renovation, they did so with a newfound tone, optimism. In comments made after a news conference that was introducing the new pitcher, Corbin Burnes, Ken Kendrick, who is the Diamondbacks' principal owner and managing general partner, and Derek Hall, the club's president and CEO, sounded far more encouraged about the possibility of finding funding for the ballpark that they had in years. Kendrick said, "I think there's some hope for us to get something done." Hall added, "We're starting to see a roadmap to get this place renovated and taken care of and brought up to speed as our fans deserve." Well, as the Arizona Republic reported last week, the Diamondbacks are pushing potential legislation at the state level that would see a portion of sales tax revenue derived from Chase Field recaptured into a fund that could be used on ballpark improvements. Kendrick drew parallels to the legislation in place for the Cardinals and State Farm Stadium. Kendrick said, "The model is already there. It's exactly what the Cardinals have." He added and said, "I'm not a fan of taking people's tax money that don't support the team. I just don't think that's fair. But if you're a fan and you come in and you buy a ticket and you pay a sales tax, that money was because the Diamondbacks are here. And if that money were to be repatriated into keeping the ballpark vibrant, would that be something the public at large would say, 'Well, yeah, that's a fair use of tax money'? Well, they voted for that for the Cardinals. That's the model." Kendrick again said that the Diamondbacks are willing to put forth their own money. He said last year the team was willing to spend, quote, "hundreds of millions," unquote, in a renovation that he said could be completed with a price tag below $500 million. Kendrick said, "Look, I personally feel very strong that the public doesn't owe us. However, if the public is coming here and spending their money, does the sales tax money go to things unrelated to the ballpark? Could it go to the ballpark? I think it could. It does for the Cardinals, so why not us?" The Diamondbacks' proposal is making the rounds at the legislature, and both lawmakers and the governor's office have acknowledged conversations with the club. And that was the article by Nick Pecoro, D-backs bullish on funding for Chase Field. And finally, we have the fourth article from the front page of the sports section, but this is ASU men's basketball. It's entitled "Putting Sun Devils Season in Perspective," written by Michelle Gardner for the Arizona Republic. Arizona State men's basketball coach Bobby Hurley took his spot in front of the media, as he does after Sun Devil games. His team just lost a close game against Central Florida, and it was late. The game did not even start until 9 p.m. Hurley, rarely at a loss for words, was trying to choose them carefully. His team had one of its best offensive performances, and yet still came up empty in the win column. He came into the season with perhaps the best roster he has had in his decade-long tenure. But the reality is the Sun Devils have transitioned to the Big 12, and there are no gimmies. While the Sun Devils are greatly improved from their 14-18 record in 23-24, they aren't winning enough to satisfy a thirsty fan base. Now, ASU sits at 10-6 overall, but only 1-4 in the first five Big 12 games. So let's break down what we've seen over the first half of the season, the positives, the negatives, and the challenges. In the best scenario, Hurley has a rotation of 8 players. Teams have 13 scholarships, but most don't use all 13. There can be a stacked roster, but the minute another quality piece is added, another player who may see that cutting into his playing time then decommits and looks for another school where he is assured of a more prominent role. Junior guard Austin Nunez is out for the season with a foot injury. He would have been a key contributor. Redshirt freshman Brandon Gardner, who's a transfer from USC, is also out of the mix due to a violation of team rules. He has yet to play, and it doesn't look like he will. An ankle injury has taken Josen Sannon out for 3 of the last 4 games, which has left Hurley down to a rotation of 7. Sannon, with 12.8 points per game, was the team's leading scorer before he sustained the injury on December 31st at BYU. Hurley has called him the best shooter he has ever coached. Now, fatigue eventually plays a role with a 7-player rotation. ASU has shown that its defensive pressure can also get it back in the game, but that is not sustainable for 40 minutes. Guard Trevor Best was recently added to the roster. He's a former high school teammate of Jaden Quaintance and graduated early so he could start at ASU this month. Hurley could add him because he had a scholarship available, but who knows whether he can help because he's still getting acclimated and he's just 17. Now, this is something that everyone is learning to navigate. The days of travel partner road trips that were so convenient in the Pac-12 are over. There are no such trips anymore. ASU doesn't even get Kansas and Kansas State on the same road trip. Now, there are standalone games in the middle of the week in different time zones. ASU had to play at Kansas on a Wednesday and had travel delays both ways, then had to deal with Baylor on a Saturday. Next up for ASU is a game at Cincinnati on Saturday, and then at West Virginia on Tuesday. And let's not forget that ASU made 3 trips to the East Coast just for non-conference play and had only 4 home games in that stretch. Now, Hurley has been criticized for the freedom that he gives his players regarding the offense. Shot selection was questionable. Too often players were just willing to put up shots from the far corners of the arena without working for a better one. Well, that isn't the case anymore, which is surprising because Hurley has 3 players who are true freshmen and transfers who were leading scorers at their previous schools. ASU averaged 69 points per game a year ago, and that is now up to 75.7. The team's shooting percentage has improved from 41% to 44%, and the 3-point improvement has gone from 30% to 37%. ASU is ranked number 50 out of 355 programs, after being one of the worst a year ago. Sannon is shooting 47.5% from deep, Adam Miller shooting 44.9%. Their free throw percentage is up from 65% to 71%, and the assists per game are up from 12 to 13.8. The only metric in which ASU is worse is turnovers. The Sun Devils are averaging 13.8. They used to be at just 10 per game. Well, it may seem like ASU's defense is worse this year than last year, but that isn't exactly the case. It depends on the category. Points given up per game is about the same, 72 this year, 74 per game last season. Rebounding is the most significant improvement. Last year, ASU was one of the worst teams in the country, with a rebounding margin of negative 7.3. This season, it's improved to 0.4. ASU went from giving up 40 rebounds per game to 36. Of course, it helps when you have a player like Jaden Quaintance. Blocks are up from 3.7 to 5.3, and that is a Quaintance effect, too, because he ranks 3rd nationally in that department, blocks. Shooting percentage is close. This year, ASU is holding opponents to 41% overall, 31% from long distance. That's slightly better than the marks of 45 and 39% a year ago. Where ASU has not been as good as in years past is on-ball defense and generating points from defense. ASU averaged 8 steals a year ago, and that's now down to 5.8. And points off the turnovers, they're down from 14.3 to 13.4. So can ASU gain some ground in the next stretch of Big 12 games? Well, time will tell. But the roster is significantly better, and the team is playing a more entertaining brand of basketball. And that was the article, Putting Sun Devil's Season in Perspective. I think we have time for one quick golf news story. J.T. Poston carded an eagle and 9 birdies en route to a 10-under par 62 and a 1-stroke lead after the opening round of the American Express on Thursday in La Quinta, California. Poston started his round on the back 9 at the Nicklaus Tournament course and came in with 32 at the turn with 4 birdies. He recovered from his lone bogey of the day at par 4 number 1 and really heated up with three straight birdies at holes numbers 2, 3, and 4. And then birdies at number 6 and 8 were sandwiched around his eagle on the par 5, 527-yard number 7 hole. Poston, who is 31, has 3 career wins on the PGA Tour, including the 2024 Shriners Children's Open last October. He started the week ranked number 35th in the official world golf ranking. And that was Poston grabs lead in Palm Springs, a sports brief. Oh, and there's one other sports brief. This is tennis. Number 4 seed Taylor Fritz continued to display his top form on Thursday at the Australian Open. He routed Chilean qualifier Christian Garin 6-2, 6-1, 6-0 in the second round action. So far in his 2 victories, Fritz has lost a total of 8 games. So you got a little tennis news, a little golf news, a little baseball news, a little basketball news, a little football news. And now let's move on over and read an opinion piece. This is written by E.J. Montini. It's entitled, Mays Won't Give 2020 Election Meddlers a Pass. Good. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays has no intention of giving a pass to those who tried to overturn the 2020 election, because she shouldn't. She has written to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland asking that the Department of Justice disclose to my office its case file in special counsel's investigation and prosecution relating to the 2020 presidential election. Well, that would be all the work done by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, not just his final report. Now, Jack Smith resigned recently after having finished his investigation into Donald Trump's effort to subvert the 2020 election. But in her letter, Mays wrote, quote, today, my office has one of the only remaining cases that includes charges against national actors. I have held steadfast to prosecuting the grand jury's indictment because those who tried to subvert democracy in 2020 must be held accountable, unquote. Now, Mays is hoping the Justice Department will give Smith the okay to pass her the baton. It was clear from the moment that Mays launched an investigation into the fake electors and their scheme to overturn the election that she was going to see it through to the end. A while back, the Republicans who control the Arizona legislature seemed to believe that the threat of impeachment would stop her. But it didn't. Back in April, a grand jury indicted 11 Arizona Republicans and 7 Trump aides on criminal conspiracy to subvert the will of the voters. Mays reached deals with 2 defendants, Jenna Ellis, whose charges were dropped after she agreed to cooperate with prosecutors, and Lorraine Pellegrino, one of the fake electors, who pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of filing a false instrument and she received 3 years probation. But when the indictments were first announced, Mays issued a statement saying, quote, "The people of Arizona elected President Biden. Unwilling to accept this fact, the defendants charged by the state grand jury allegedly schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency. I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It's too important," unquote. So she is asking Smith be allowed to pass her the baton. Or is it a hammer? And that was E.J. Montini's opinion piece, "Mays Won't Give 2020 Election Meddlers a Pass." Good. We're coming up on 46 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section and begin by reading today's horoscopes. Aries is the first sign of the zodiac. Birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Is this your opportunity to rule with gentleness? Wield your authority with empathy. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, dream the big dream. Your idealism can be realistic. Are you ready to realize your wishes? For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, strategic funding can advance your career goals now. Put the money where your ambitions are. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, partnerships provide spiritual growth today. Are your relational efforts paying off? Step back to see how far you have come. For Leo, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you achieving your flow state? A health or work transition that you have committed to may finally get its groove. Relax into it. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, teaming up gets your creative juices flowing. A dreamy collaboration is in the making. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, a healing practice will nourish your depths. Are you feeling an emotional flow? Find your spiritual center. For Scorpio, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, are creative expressions pouring out of you? Because you are in touch with the muse today. For Sagittarius, birth dates from November 22nd through December 21st, the home life that you are dreaming of may need strategic planning. Get creative with manifestation. Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th birth dates. Your words may take on an inspirational yet grounded quality. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates. Your understanding of acquirement and possession may shift. Are you ready to let go of the material? And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Build your dream community. The Sun's coordination with Neptune offers the opportunity to make meaningful connections. Lead the way. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my husband and I have 4 kids, so there are many, many appointments to make and keep. We both have full-time jobs, so we split up the responsibilities by category. I get the pediatrician visits, and he does the dentist and the orthodontist. Well, this works fine for me, but for some reason, these offices are stubbornly unwilling to communicate with him as a parent. No matter who is listed as the contact person, they always call me the mother. The dentist is particularly bad. They have my husband listed as the main contact. He's the one who makes all the appointments and takes the kids. My name is listed only as an emergency contact. But they still call me with the reminders and the schedule changes. And if I don't respond, they text me repeatedly. One time, my husband was late getting to their office, and they called and yelled at me about his lateness. I said I wasn't sure what they expected me to do about his being late, because I was on a business trip and out of the state that day. We have explained multiple times that he is the person they need to talk to, and that I am not involved in those appointments. We even had them put notes in the kids' records, but they still call me first. Do you have any suggestions about how to overcome this bias that doesn't include me taking over the whole family calendar? Signed, Ignored in Delaware. And Abby responds, Dear Ignored, I certainly do. It appears someone in this dental practice is tone deaf. Rather than discuss this again with the office staff, you or your husband should complain directly to the dentist. Tell them this is a mistake that happens repeatedly, and that if it happens one more time, you will take your business elsewhere, and then follow through. Our next letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my husband of 58 years is an alcoholic, but not a mean one. He used to be the life of the party, but now his days consist of playing games on the computer and going to his friend's house to drink. He has lost so much weight. He used to like to go places, but no longer. The kids have noticed the changes. So have the grandchildren. I am at my wit's end because I don't know what the matter is. His doctors say he's fine, but he's not. What can I do now? Signed, Out of Ideas in Texas. Dear Out, your husband may need a second opinion about his health. While there may be nothing physically wrong with him yet, it appears there may be plenty wrong with him emotionally. He may suffer from depression. He may need to be evaluated neurologically or psychologically. Something has driven his change in behavior, but no one can solve what's wrong until you get to the bottom of it. You may be able to gain insight by attending some Al-Anon meetings and discussing this with others who are in the same boat. You can find them at the website alanon.org/info. Those were the two letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. If you want to contact Abigail, you can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were our letters of advice from Abigail Van Buren. Time now to take a look at some comics. In the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood and his friend Herb, who lives next door, are standing outside at the hedge between the two properties, and they're all bundled up, and Herb says, Boy, it is a cold one today. And Dagwood says, It sure is. And then in the second frame, they look at each other. And in the third frame, Herb says, Good talk. And Dagwood turns and starts to walk away and says, See you tomorrow when it's warmer. And that was Blondie. And then in Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, there's Jeremy laying on the sofa with his feet over the back of the sofa, looking on his phone. And he says, Nope, no, seen it, nope. Bad review. In the second frame, he smiles and goes, Oh, wait, here's one. And in the third frame, now we see that his dad is sitting on the other end of the sofa. And his dad is thinking, Why does picking the movie take longer than watching it? Because Jeremy is now saying, Okay, now let's choose the platform to watch this on. And that was Zits. And we have Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. And Beetle's brushing his teeth, and Private Zero is brushing his teeth. And Beetle says, Have you ever thought about getting your teeth fixed? And Private Zero says, No. And Beetle says, Well, why not? And then in the last frame, Private Zero picks up his floss, and he says, They're easy to floss. And it looks like he has two big front teeth sticking way out there. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then in Peanuts, drawn by Charles Schulz, Linus and Sally are walking along, and Sally says, "Now, if some kid comes up and starts asking about a ruler, you hold him off." And Linus says, "Hold him off?" And Sally turns and says, "Yeah, you hold him off while I run for it." And then Linus says, "Well, what if he tries to hit me?" And Sally says, "Reason with him." And in the last frame, she says, "Tell him his stupid ruler wouldn't have been any good after we switched to metrics anyway." And that was Peanuts. And in Baby Blues, the comic strip drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, and Daryl, the dad, is sitting in his chair looking at his phone, and in comes Hammy in his cardboard box, and he says, "I am Hambot. I am programmed to perform jobs for you." And Dad goes, "Cool." And then in the second frame, Dad says, "Hambot, go get me a beer." And Hammy turns and starts walking away going, "Affirmative." And then in the third frame, Hammy's back and he says, "That function has been overridden." And there's Mom. And she looks at Dad and says, "Not exactly a parent of the year moment, Buster." And that was Baby Blues. Okay, let's wish happy birthday to some celebrities today. Talk show host Maury Povich turns 86 today. Actor and comedian Steve Harvey turns 68. And actor Jim Carrey turns 63. And musician Kid Rock turns 54. And actress and singer Zooey Deschanel turns 45. Congratulations to them. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. You've been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Friday, January 17th, 2025. Have a great day. Bye-bye.